Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
If you're struggling with drugs, alcohol, gambling or food, or concerned about somebody who is, tune in to the Living Free Show on 3CR at 1 p.m. every Thursday.
I don't know how I got there, but and I couldn't stop it.
I had stopped expecting that anybody cared.
Never enough. I'm never enough. It's never enough. He's never enough.
That was the confusion.
Tune in to Living Free, Stories of Recovery from Addictive Behaviour, Thursdays at 1 p.m. on 3CR. Or listen at 3CR on digital radio or podcasts and live streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Being able to centre myself and be okay in myself and turn my world around.
Living Free. Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. I'm Anne, and I'm in the studio today with Zakia. Hi, Zakia.
Hi, Anne.
We together would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present, and to acknowledge that the land was stolen and sovereignty never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we discuss one of the many programs that assist in recovery from the effects of drugs, alcohol, gambling, food, and other addictions. Our guest today has called in sick, so we're going to be digging into the archives a bit and just doing a bit of chit-chat. But so we'll just to remind you, the Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm, and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others when listening. So if anything does come up along those lines, we'll talk about that after the little clip that I'm going to play, because basically I'm just going to be playing little clips, even though I don't even know what they're going to say, but we're just going to put them on and enjoy whatever we hear. So this one coming up, completely at random, is a person called Dan, and they're talking about Alateen, which is the sort of junior part of Al-Anon. So Alateen is a place where young people or teenagers can go and discuss some of the problems they're facing as a result of living in a family where alcohol is abused. So Dan is a member of Al-Anon, and he grew up in a household in which another person's drinking was out of control. He had one parent who he says was safe and nurturing during the day, but in the evenings became what he describes as a dangerous presence. And this inconsistency resulted in Dan feeling confused about how to trust people and eventually angry and distant from his parents. And at 15, he went to Alateen, where he found it healing to be in the company of other teenagers who understood his situation, didn't judge him, and spoke authentically about their own experience. So let's just put this on at random, and let's hear what Dan has to say about growing up in a family where alcohol is abused.
It's not necessarily about the emotion you're expressing. It's the fact that you're trying to express yourself with a certain sort of authenticity, and you're trying to make the music about something that is real, real in your character, real in your life, real in your emotions. And when you can do that, it takes a certain amount of courage to do that. But when you can do that, and when you connect with someone, it builds a real kind of relationship.
That's great to hear you talk about that authenticity, because I think one of the things that I came out of the alcoholic situation that I grew up in with was a sense of not being able to express myself authentically, different era, and also it was more shameful. So there was a whole part of me that was not expressed because I was hiding the fact that my household was so dysfunctional. So that's very encouraging to hear that happened. Can you take us, before we're going to a break in a minute, can you take us to the point where you decided to go to an Alateen meeting?
Yes. My mother convinced me somehow, I still don't remember how, but to go to a meeting at some point. And I think the only reason I went is because that day I bought my first Megadeth album, which was a classic metal band. I heard that. And I think I went with the intention of like putting my iPod headphones in my ears and covering my ears with my hair. The audience can't see, but I've got long hair. And sort of sitting there as I did in class and sort of wagging by just listening to music and not paying attention. So I thought, this is going to be fine. You know, I can sort of upset myself. But I got there and I was told that I can't listen to my iPod, which was somewhat disappointing. I had the experience of my first ever Alateen meeting. And again, just to pick up on that theme of authenticity, that's one of the first things I experienced in the rooms. So,
Song, that was a little bit of Dan chatting to Mitch and I about basically what he was talking about there was the loss of authenticity when you're living in a very dysfunctional family, because you learn that you can't be, or you sort of assume that you can't be authentic because you feel that you can't express the whole truth of who you are. And that's amazing that that's just come on, because Zakia and I have been chatting recently about that all the different ways that sometimes we get othered or we're unable to be our authentic self. And Zakia's current issue with that is not having full command yet of the English language, therefore feels that she can't express herself as she would wish. So do you want to talk about that a little bit, Zakia? And we might hear a little bit more of Dan after that.
Yes, and that was interesting. They were talking loss of authenticity. It is, I think, a bit complicated to understand those kind of situation and to express yourself or to wish to be yourself. But it is also difficult for you, like, for me, it's as like I'm learning English and I'm in the process of learning, and also I'm struggling to express myself at the moment. You know what I mean?
Right now, in this, what you're saying right now, you mean?
Right now or over the process of learning.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Now, tell everyone who doesn't know where you grew up.
I grew up in Afghanistan.
And tell everyone else what your education is and what your profession was.
I was a journalist. I was working in Afghanistan for a long time and confident.
Yes.
We just moved. We just left the country, or they made us to leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm here and learning everything from the scratch.
From scratch. Well done. Now you're using Australian idioms and slangs now. So can you just talk about what happens sometimes when you speak and just in normal conversation, and what happens that inhibits you and makes you lose your confidence sometimes now that you're speaking in a different language?
That's a good question, Anne. The things that I'm struggling a lot is people cannot understand my accent, or I'm not using the proper word in the sentence that to make people to understand me. And I think some people generally don't understand, and they want to understand, but most of the time I feel that people just want to just enjoying the time, that want to ask me things again and again, just wanted me to learn the way they are speaking. You know what I mean?
So I think what you're saying is instead of having an authentic conversation with them about whatever the topic is, and as a intelligent, educated, qualified person, you might want to talk about politics, or religion or culture, but you end up talking about your use of language and how the correct pronunciation is.
Yeah. And it is like I don't feel that authentic authenticity.
Yeah, you can't express your true self.
Yeah, I cannot express my true self. It caused lots of... I lose my confidence. And I'm trying to learn how to get back to be true to myself.
Learning how to get back to yourself.
Yeah.
Beautifully put. So this is it's a very interesting parallel between this Living Free show. It's about living free of addiction, but it's also about living free of, you know, those sort of social handicaps, you might call them, that we get that happen to us for all different reasons. So people that are affected by other people that have had addictions, like Dan, who we just heard, they're also trying to get back to an authentic self that was taken away from them.
Yeah.
In that alcoholic situation. So there's so many different ways.
Yeah, and that was interesting the way they said, the way they were healing or coping, just listening to music. That was interesting.
Tell me more about why you found that interesting.
I mean, when you're in this situation, it is the way that you can do something different to cope or to heal, you know what I mean? To come back.
To yourself.
To yourself.
Because the music we like so much a part of ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So what do you listen to if you need to get back to Zakia and not just Zakia, the object of someone else's interest?
That's interesting questions. And also, like, for me, and when it comes to music, when they were talking about the music, and I said, I am so confused at the time. I'm saying, oh, let me listen to my own country music. And also, I don't have much, at this time, I don't have much connection with my music, with the country I can't, like, mm-hmm. because the music is lots of, like, for love, like, very, like, not my type of music.
Romantic music.
Romantic music, like, from war, from those kind of stuff. And also, I love, like, Western music or English music. I don't understand most of the context.
Yes.
But I also just, whatever is happening, I'm just going to listening to music, English music, try to put myself or to push myself. Oh, you have to learn this language and also you have to enjoy it.
Yes.
Yeah, and yeah. I think I'm getting used to enjoy it this yeah. time. Yeah.
Very interesting. So you said you didn't understand the context. I know what it is to be a migrant too, although not as in such difficult circumstances as you. And it you do have this thing of, I don't understand the context of what's going on here. But it's the same thing when you come out of an alcoholic home. You get into a normal so-called normal situation and you don't understand the context. You know, you're operating in a different sort of way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we're going to put on a little bit more of Dan.
In effect, practice the program better so that I can be, a better son, so that I can be a better friend to my friends, so that I can be one day a better spouse, a better father.
Is that the goal ultimately?
Yeah, that's one of the goals. That's one of the goals certainly. But I think here what you got to think about in the case of alcoholism, particularly in a situation like mine where you're an adult child of an alcoholic, so you grew up around alcoholism. There's all sorts of impacts that alcoholism has had on you that you're still carrying around in all sorts of strange ways. And so you've got to be prepared to accept that you've got to go on a bit of a journey to try and understand how alcohol has had an influence over you, and then to try and change your behaviors, your thought patterns, and your emotional responses so that you don't pass on those kinds of vices and traits and problems to the next generation, to the people over which you have an influence.
I'm going to go straight to intimate relationships now because that's where a lot of the damage is done because it's about trust and control and stuff. Can you talk about how that's manifested for you? Have you seen any connections with that, mm-hmm. how you are in those relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
I mean, without going into too much of the gory details, you put your finger on it. I mean, it's the question of control. When you grow up around alcoholism, you want control over things. You want control over people. You want control over people, places, and things. And so the hardest thing to accept when you've allowed someone to penetrate so deep into your emotional life, as we do with our intimate relationships, is that you ultimately don't have the right or responsibility of governing this person's life. I mean, of course, in a relationship, there's all sorts of give and take, and that's an important part of a relationship. It's an important part of a healthy relationship. But what happens when you're tremendously influenced by the presence of alcoholism in your life is that your tendency to want to influence the other person gets completely out of whack. And so the slightest sign of them going off the rails gives you the sorts of warning bells that you might have had as a child when your parents were going off the rails. The slightest sign in my own intimate relationships that my girlfriend is not living well or is not living up to who I think that she could be, for me, is an indication that everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket as it did when I was a child. So you tend to respond to that by going, look, I know best. Just let me control your life. Let me do everything. And, you know, understandably, that's not going to be good for a relationship. No one wants to be in a relationship with a tyrant.
If I could just jump in. So you were pretty much saying if you could see things that weren't happening or unfolding in the way that you think that they should, you have the tendency or the desire to want to control that, or it gives you some kind of grief. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. I mean, that's been my experience in the past. However, Al-Anon and Alateen before it helped teach me how to escape those kinds of inherited emotional and behavior patterns, right? So that's the tendency. That's kind of the hand you've been dealt because you grew up around alcoholism. Okay, that's not your fault. But at the same time, I have now the capacity to understand what's going on and to behave differently. And part of that, as we were speaking about just before, is coming to accept that you don't have control over people, places, and things. And when you can do that, you can be in a much better position to have a healthy relationship.
That authenticity thing's important there too, because another thing that you gain by going to meetings and understanding that it's okay to be completely authentic, it means that in an intimate relationship, if you are getting irrational, well, all feelings are irrational or non-rational, but if you if the panic stations are starting because the person, you know, looked in a certain direction or ate whatever it is that's caused you to have the panic, that you can say that to the person rather than don't do that, but I'm starting to feel worried about this or something, and then it is expressed properly and not in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And again, what that represents is the fact that you've taken a step back from the situation. You've taken a step back and you can actually detach and view what's going on. Sufficiently to be able to then communicate as a, you know, sort of a rational actor rather than just an emotional force, you know, and that's important in a relationship.
And I feel like you are an emotionally intelligent person, and I feel like some of that may have come from Alateen and being able to discuss your feelings in this manner. Have you found that it's helped you in your relationships, being able to discuss intimate issues?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, part of that is just my character. I think part of that influences my work as a philosophy student and has influenced my musicianship as well. I mean, authenticity, emotional authenticity, is an incredibly important part of any attempt to communicate with anyone, right? So none of really what we're saying here is going to be restricted to the domain of intimate relationships. There's going to be cross-pollination here with any kind of relationship that we're going to have, because people want to see that you're honest. People want to see that you're able to communicate what's really going on for you, not in a burdensome way for other people, but in a manner that represents that you have a certain amount of control and understanding over what's going on for you internally, so that you can actually influence other people in your actions in a beneficial way.
But going back to art as well, I feel like that's what makes any good art enjoyable. It's the authenticity.
Yes.
And it's the fact that the artist is clearly trying to connect with people through their work.
Definitely. I would agree. Yeah. Authenticity and craft. You know, it's got to be part inspiration, part, you know, emotional discharge. But at the same time, it's doing that in a controlled and sort of virtuous manner, if I could put it that way.
So it's a great idea, isn't it, to think that the trauma through the 12 steps, the trauma of addiction, whether it's your own addiction or the impact of someone else's addiction on you, can lead you to this wisdom, that this hard-won wisdom that's, you know, as you say, goes back to Marcus Aurelius and the Stoics and Socrates and everything. What a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a wonderful way to bring up a child.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really why I feel so lucky for having been given the opportunity to go to Alateen, because in those formative years, you're looking for some kind of guide or some kind of compass to tell you which choice to make when you come to all those different crossroads as a teenager, right? And what you have in Alateen is all kinds of wisdom, as we've talked about, being presented to you in a highly digestible form. But at the same time, it's the opportunity to make relationships with people who are also trying to govern their lives with that kind of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that for me, the kind of that feeling I described before, the sense of lightness or the unburdening that I experienced the first time I went to Alateen, that feeling itself, in a way, became my kind of North Star as a teenager, because it was a feeling of joy or pleasure in a real good, not a fake good, not something that's self-destructive ultimately, but a true good that if you pursue, ultimately will lead you to the best kind of life you can have. I'm very lucky to have had Alateen.
And I think that feelings or that state is freedom. I think it's called freedom.
Yes.
It's freedom from desire and all of that stuff. And it's why we call the show Living Free.
Right.
Nice. Right on the nose.
We're nearly done now. So keeping in mind that there may be someone listening who is a teenager, or someone listening who has got a teenager in their life that they think this might help with, what's your message? What can you say?
Yeah. Go and look and see. Because I don't ultimately think that the value of what we're talking about here could be encapsulated in some sort of set of ideas or some logical proof that I could write up on a whiteboard to convince someone to go and try Alateen or Al-Anon. Ultimately, it's something you have to experience for yourself. And if you experience that unburdening, that sense of lightness or joy, then it's going to work for you, and it's going to be a good thing in your life.
Mm-hmm. And it's not heavy philosophy at all. Many people just, they go, and what they get from it is that sitting in that room where they're not being judged and where they can speak the truth. And that in itself goes a long way, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Any final comments from Mitch?
No. I think you've summed it up really well. And, I wish we could get you on every week, you know. This has been a really fruitful conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
We're going to hear now from Mandy from Al-Anon again, and we'll go into some of the other 12-step programs after this, but we'll start off with another Al-Anon one. And Mandy grew up in a household dominated by an angry father who, from the time Mandy was 3 years old, was a sober alcoholic. Her mother was passive, and other members of the family fell into roles that made sense to them to manage the situation. Mandy tried to be the good girl who didn't cause any trouble. As an adult, Mandy had her first child with a sober alcoholic, then married and built a family with a man whose drinking soon became a problem. Both Mandy and her husband now practice the 12 steps, and Mandy has, through facing very difficult situations, learned the true meaning of surrender. I think we might start at the beginning, near the beginning of the discussion with Mandy, and then go to the end where she talks about recovery.
Ken, brother, he was a free thinker. He just wanted to get out in nature, and he was doing that from the age of two. And it was all right. Where is he? And you need to find him for my sister.
Uh-huh.
So she was the shepherd. The next one was the wayward child.
The naughty one.
The naughty one, the second naughty child, which is usually the case in most families.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was the prim and proper, Miss Goody Two Shoes, and the baby got all the attention, right? They can't do anything wrong.
So how did your siblings deal with your dad's anger? Because I can only imagine how confusing it would have been, because at least with the alcohol you can pinpoint it to something, right? Yeah. Whereas he just was angry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my sister, she was verbally tried to control him.
The eldest one?
Yep, the eldest one, yeah. And then the next one, you know, he just took it, really. Mm. And, I think they had their own ways of dealing with it.
And how did your mum deal with it?
She was passive.
Mm. Yep.
Passive controller.
Well, how does that look? Explain to the audience how passive controlling looks.
Yeah. So it means you don't stand up for anything and you just don't stand up to him because you don't want him to get angrier and you want the children to get in line so that we don't poke the bear pretty much.
No conflict. You know, it's just easier that way.
Yes, yeah.
So he'd be set off with any old thing then with noise or... Because he was uncomfortable in his own skin, right?
Yes.
So anything would set him off?
Yes, yeah.
And do you know about, like, what his recovery would look like or, you know, after he got sober, was it a day-to-day thing that he was trying to practice to keep his sobriety or...?
Yes, yeah. The one thing I'll give him is that he was committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he tried his hardest to go to meetings and to be there for other alcoholics, and he did that very well. But to be fair, he got sober in 1966. Alcoholics Anonymous hadn't been long in Australia, and the program of recovery really wasn't practiced.
It was about staying sober.
Yeah.
It was helping each other stay sober, and it was all guys, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly that. Yeah.
So there wouldn't have been a lot of delving into what your issues are that you've brought with you into your marriage or anything.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
Sure, totally different time. Yeah. And what were your own teenage years like, Mandy?
So I was just, like, so sensitive, so self-conscious. I couldn't talk to boys. I was just really uptight, socially awkward. I was with a group of girls that were quite outwardly aggressive and, you know, when I say that, they swore and that sort of thing, because now I see that I needed protection.
Oh, okay, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I needed protection because I was so insecure myself.
And how did they offer that to you in social scenarios?
Yeah, well, they would just verbally... you know, say whatever they like to people to pull them into line. And, and I just thought, oh, I'm protected here.
So you're in the gang.
Yeah, I was in the gang. And I only realised that because I met up with a girl once. I was already an adult and I went to a doctor's office and she was a receptionist. She goes, "We were so scared of you." Think of me, like I'm a harmless little fly, you know. But I understood when she said that
by association, almost.
Yes,
you know, it's like you represent who you're hanging out with.
Yes, almost. Exactly. Yeah.
And what a survival skill! You can just see how that works, isn't it? You've learned it at home, and you've just taken it into the world with you, and it's working for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't do very well as a teenager. Didn't have a boyfriend till I was 17. I just couldn't even contemplate that. I was just so awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And the other girls in the group, they had boyfriends earlier than that?
Yes.
And they were good with that?
Yes, yeah. Well, my very best friend, she met her husband when she was 13.
Oh.
Wow.
And he was 14 and they're still married and they live around the corner from us.
Yeah. No way.
Wow.
Times have changed, I was going to say. You don't see that too often.
Yeah. What about parties and stuff? Did you not go to parties and hook up with people?
Yeah, so when I went to parties, I wasn't allowed to go out till I was 16.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
I don't know about you, but we were really dominated.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went out to parties, a lot of my girlfriends love drinking as well, and they still do. And I just never wanted to touch it, alcohol. So I drank Coke and I couldn't talk to boys.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I don't really like labelling it because I just think, and I've heard philosophers and that say that God has been an overused and controlling word in a lot of people's lives. And so for me it's either creative intelligence, power of the universe, nature... You know, like you can't see the wind, but you can see where the wind's been. That sort of thing, just not even really knowing what it is, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But as soon as you say God, people more or less know what you're talking about or alluding to.
Yes.
Yeah. But they might get it wrong, and they might, because they've got their preconceptions, they might think it means
exactly,
Jesus' father or something.
Mm. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's not, my conception. Yeah.
And was your family religious at all growing up?
Mum went to church, and I went to church with my girlfriend. Yeah, and her family. I think I liked what was going on for them.
How did you use the program to help you cope with that desperate fear for your daughter?
Yeah, so I had to really look at step one in my powerlessness, because I was powerless over that.
Totally. Mm.
You know, and I could divorce my husband, but I couldn't divorce my child.
Right.
You know, and so I was really powerless then. And I didn't even realise that I was a controller and that I was trying to control my whole life.
You'd be trying to control her too, because you think you're saving her life.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So so a lady was able to say to me, you can go through the 12 steps and, you know, and look at your control issues and be restored to sanity.
Mm.
Would you talk directly now to anyone out there who's got a child that's using drugs in a dangerous way about how that first step can help?
Yeah, so, you know, that we admitted we're powerless over whatever, the child, you know, or the drugs or whatever, and it makes my life unmanageable because I go into obsession about how I'm going to fix that kid, you know, and so for me... I didn't want to go there because I knew that putting my life on the line to try and save her was going to actually make it worse for her and me, for both of us. You know, I suppose the one gift I got from my parents is that they let us have our own experience. They let us make our own mistakes and learn from them. You know, and I was able to do that with Carly and to say, you know, you're a big girl, you can do whatever you like, you know, but I don't want to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Al-Anon definitely gave me the courage to do that.
To say that.
You know, how do you say that to your child when you're full of fear? Because the biggest fear is they are going to die.
Yeah.
And how did the relationship progress after you were honest and you said that?
Yeah, so she continued. She took another drug overdose 2 years later.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be a bystander in that and watch it. And definitely Al-Anon has given me the courage to do that. And
you turned away from it. You didn't look at it. Yep.
Yeah, I turned away from her. And I said to her, I love you. I adore you, but I cannot watch your life go down the toilet.
Yeah.
Mm.
And she said that that was a turning point for her. It broke her heart. And she thanked me probably maybe 6 years later.
Yeah.
And said that was the best thing you could have ever done, Mum.
Wow, that's a really powerful message there. So you said, I love you, I adore you, but I cannot watch you put your life, do this to your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And it took 6 years for her to come and admit that to you?
Yeah, so it took her another 2 years of going down that road again. And look, if I hadn't have been in Al-Anon, I would have had her in rehab. I would have said, you're a drug addict, you're a loser, that's it, that's your life, you know, for the rest of your life. But because I was able to take her hands off, she just did what every kid that age does and explored drugs and alcohol. And when she was 23, she made a decision and said, if I keep going down this road, I'm not going to be able to fulfil my dreams of getting married and having children. And she stopped.
Mm.
So, you know, see, we can get caught up in trying to prevent these children having their experience and working out whether, you know, they have an addiction or not.
Mm.
And she doesn't.
And at least she didn't have you criticising her or smothering her either with love. You just were there as a strong, loving presence.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to make light of that problem, but it just reminds me of someone else talking about the show Schitt's Creek. And I don't watch that show, but some character on that says to other characters, I really love that journey for you.
I love the journey.
For you.
For you.
I'm not going to do that, but you can do that if you want.
I'll observe. Hope you have a good time.
So that was Mandy talking about her experience. Initially, she was talking there about her experience as a daughter of a sober alcoholic that was prone to anger and control. And then later on, after her daughter, many decades later, her daughter had a drug overdose. And then she talked about how Al-Anon allowed her to surrender to that and support her daughter in the best way that she could. We might hear from an alcoholic person next, but Zaki, have you got any comments? I mean, you don't have to, I'm just giving you the opportunity. Well, no, not really. Okay, that's cool. Okay, we're gonna hear now from an alcoholic person who identifies as an alcoholic. Her name is Jenny, and Jenny grew up with young parents and had a disadvantaged childhood. She was eager to fit in, and she learned early not to reveal much of herself and just reflect the values of others. So lack of authenticity again. She didn't think it was safe to be authentic. This show would be about authenticity if I'd known which way it was going to go. Jenny found moving from the UK to Australia in her early teens quite traumatic, and in her late teens left home and went to live with an acquaintance in St Kilda. Her reasonably quiet life fairly quickly transformed to smoking dope and then hard drugs. She didn't like the effects of alcohol, and it was never an issue in the early days. Drugs led Jenny into prostitution, theft, and eventually prison. But there she was able to go back to university, graduate, and work in a profession that she chose. But she kept being drawn back into drug use and sex work to pay for her habit. Eventually, she stopped using amphetamines and picked up alcohol, which proved to have a much stronger hold on her. After a medical incident at 68, Jenny realized that she would have to give up alcohol to get well, and she approached Alcoholics Anonymous for help.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio, live streaming on 3cr.org.au. And today I'm talking with Jenny about alcoholism and drug addiction and her recovery through the fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. So, Jenny, before the break, we were talking about getting out of prison in India. So do you want to tell us a bit about the immediate aftermath of that and, I guess, getting back to Australia and then how your life changed once you had that experience?
Well, yes, look, you would think that experience would have been enough, but it wasn't. And my drug use accelerated, and the heroin stage and anything else that I could accelerated to the point where I decided with a girlfriend that I was sharing a house with to withdraw from our methadone maintenance. Again, being bolshy, we didn't like the restrictions of the clinic and the urine samples, and that we thought it was punitive and lecturing and so on and so forth. Let's do cold turkey, we thought, and we'll get hold of a whole lot of barbiturates, we'll knock ourselves out, and that will be the end of that. So not looking at all at what were the circumstances that made me behave so insanely, just thinking that all I have to do is put down the heroin quickly and I'll be okay. I wasn't recognising that the heroin was really a solution for me. Okay, at this stage, I still really drank very little. The consequence of that attempt to cold turkey was that I ended up holding up a chemist around the corner. A week later, I was busted for that. And I got a four-year maximum service sentence with a two-year minimum. I was on bail for a year. I continued to use. But I think my actual using illegally had cut down because I was on methadone. In Fairley, I did my HSC again. I was there for, I served about 16 months of the 2 years. I got into university. I started going to university. So the governor said, I've just replaced one addiction with another. So I was clean when I got out fairly. However, I went back to the same boyfriend I had, and 2 days later, I was using again, but still going to university and kind of trying to control my drug use to some extent. Not all that successfully, but I was just, I did manage to get my degree. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about a lot of things that happened in the meantime. There was a lot of trauma, I think. For example, the partner that I returned to, he suicided, and I felt a lot, very much responsible for not getting help as quickly as I should have done, not recognising his symptoms, because he was in bed next to me. And when the ambulance came, he was dead. And I think that I already had untreated alcoholism, addictive behaviours, and that death, which I felt a lot of guilt for, and I have made amends to that person through my sponsor. Even though they're dead, you can still make amends. And that triggered a descent into amphetamine use, which became worse than my heroin use had been. Very, very quickly, I degenerated into, I remember one point even needing money to score. And while I went back to working in brothels, and they're full-blown brothels by this stage where anything goes. Still illegal. And I remember one day, for example, needing the money so desperately that I walked out onto Ackland Street near where I lived and got a couple of jobs really quickly on the street. So I mean, really, I had no self-esteem at all by that point, none. And that's where I started to drink, because I found I could drink with him and not get drunk. I mentioned before, I don't like being drunk. However, I cannot stop drinking. And it took me a long time to recognise that that pattern of not being able to stop drinking was what makes me alcoholic. I masked it from myself and was in denial for so long, I think, because once I mostly put down the amphetamines, and then I picked up drinking even more, I would ring my speed dealer, not wanting to, but in order to sober myself up so that I could get some of the work done that I brought home. So I thought I was functioning because I had a job, a fairly responsible job, but I was not doing it well at all. And I was cautioned about my behaviour, which was quite shocking. I'm also ashamed to say that at that point of my life, when I was using amphetamines and drinking, doing both, and I brought very toxic, I had a relationship breakup with the father of my children. My son stayed with his dad, he was 14. My daughter, I had my daughter, and I brought some dreadful people into her life. And I was also in toxic, abusive relationships. I stole her childhood from her. I was totally, that's what addictions, that's what alcohol does. I think to most people, if we hit the rock bottom that most of us need, become totally self-absorbed, totally self-centered, and totally rationalising what a behaviour is doing to other people. So she has seen things and experienced things that no child should have to. And that's something I don't.
We need to end that there. That was, we just heard from Jenny there talking about the difficulty she got herself into with amphetamines, heroin, and eventually alcohol, and the dreadful impact it had on her child, her daughter, and a lot of things came up in that discussion. So if anything's come up and you're feeling quite desperate about it, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14, or go to lifeline.org.au. If you're concerned about the drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon family groups, then you can phone them on 1300 252 666, or go online at alanon.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.